You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. We love movies like Mission Impossible because all that daring do is, well, impossible in real life. Or not. A heist in London a few years ago was dubbed the Mission Impossible Theft because the thieves seem to have borrowed a few moves from Tom Cruise. But these operatives ended up with rare books, not CIA files. Mark Wertman tells the story in the April edition of Vanity Fair. It's titled The Case of the Purloined Books. Wertman is a journalist and popular historian, and he joins me now. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Thank you, Tenery. Happy to be here.
Now, what did detectives see when they arrived at the crime scene?
So the Scotland Yard detectives walked in and looked up to the roof that was cut open, and at their feet were empty steel cases that had, and a few old books that were on the floor, and those steel cases had been, the day before, packed with rare, extremely valuable books.
Okay, so the thieves came in through the roof.
Yeah. Yeah, somehow this is a large warehouse, if you could imagine, something like one of our logistics warehouses, set right near Heathrow Airport, where material coming in or going out to other places in Europe or overseas spends the night, gets cleared for customs, and then ships on. And somehow the thieves climbed a sheer face of an exterior wall after breaking into a fenced-in area, warehouse zone, climbed the sheer face of an exterior wall, scaled a wet pitched roof, metal roof, cut open a fiberglass skylight, and somehow lowered themselves down to the floor, all without setting off any alarms, of which there were numerous alarms. And once they were inside...
Well, what about cameras? Would there have been cameras to have caught them?
So they avoided the cameras. Part of what these thieves managed to do was to figure out where the cameras would be pointed, which was at the doors, and to attack the warehouse from an angle by which they wouldn't be picked up by the cameras. And then by coming in through the roof, they managed not to set off the various interior alarms, motion detector alarms, within the interior of the warehouse.
And so what books were stolen, and how much were they worth?
Wow, they were some of the most important books in European history. There was Isaac Newton's Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. That's the book where he describes gravity and the laws of physics. There was a book that had once belonged to Albert Einstein. There was the astronomer Johannes Kepler's The Cosmic Mystery, which where he first laid out the idea that the planets are in motion.
That was not a new copy, right? That was an old copy.
No, these books were most typically 300 to 500 years old. These were among the very earliest books printed in some cases, and they were very rare. In some cases, they were unique because of the markings that were on the books by previous owners and the ways which for scholars and collectors make them very valuable for understanding how knowledge spreads, and also created value just by their rarity. Mm. In the case of the of one book, by Copernicus on the revolution of the heavenly spheres, which was where he created the theory that the that the Earth and the other planets revolve around the sun, that one copy alone was worth almost $300,000. You know, the value, total value of the book stolen, there were about 240 of them that included a sheath of prints by the artist Goya and some lots and lots of other materials. And the total value was placed at about $3.4 million, one haul of books.
So who did they belong to? I'm assuming they were in transit since they were at a warehouse near the airport.
Yes, yes. So these books were on their way to an antiquarian fair. So they belonged to dealers. One was in Germany. Two were in Italy, who were shipping their stock of rare books to this major fair that takes place each year in California, where international dealers from around the world and collectors, scholars, archivists will come to buy rarities. And so this was a shipment of hundreds of books, and the thieves somehow became aware of their presence in this warehouse. They were there for less than 24 hours, or scheduled to be there less than 24 hours, and chose that moment to come in and make off with them.
Did the thieves strike any other locations, or were they just after this haul of books?
So this was by no means their only break-in. So they hit the previous month, they had hit a different warehouse in a somewhat similar manner, in which they'd made off with primarily with electronics. A few days after they struck the warehouse holding the books, they struck another warehouse in a different style raid, but in which they made off with cash. And they continued to strike warehouses around England, mainly in the London area, but some as far afield as a couple hundred miles from London.
Why books? They could have targeted jewelry or, you know, or artwork. Why do you think books? I would think that they'd be kind of like, you know, masterpieces where there can't be that many of, you know, Johannes Kepler's own copy. So how do you go about selling, reselling something like that?
Yeah, so that's I would say the $64,000 question, except it was more like the $3.4 million question. So the authorities have not figured that one out yet, and we can, if you want, we can jump ahead to talk about who these thieves were and what they were about, and that may give us some sense as to why they might have taken books. You know, books, rare books are, even in the best of circumstances, rare books can be hard to sell. You know, add to that, although there are collectors and scholarly archives covet these books, but they can be very difficult to sell if they were stolen, because mm-hmm. you know, there are only so many copies of these books, and the dealers, the owners, know exactly what they have. And as soon as these books were stolen, it went out on the web to dealers around the world that these very specific copies of known titles had been stolen. So if somebody wanted to sell them in any way on the open market, it would be like trying to sell, I don't know, a stolen Rembrandt or Van Gogh or something like that. It's all speculation at this point. The defendants in this case, the burglars, never explained their motives. It's possible they simply knew from some inside source that there was something valuable in this warehouse, that it was going to be there very briefly, and that it was worth a lot of money. And maybe they just came in and found, oh, it's books. We'll take the books. It's also possible that there's somebody out there who wanted these books or wanted some of the books. And finally, it's possible that a gang of thieves looked at books, rare cultural treasures like this, and said, this is something that should we get caught, we can use this as a kind of collateral, you know, where we can return the books in return for a reduced sentence. Something like, you know, an insurance policy. But we still don't know.
I do want to just ask you kind of a side note. I'm just trying to get an idea for the market value of rare books, just in general, because we know paintings can sell for hundreds of millions. I mean, how much does one book, like, what's the most expensive book ever sold? Or you know, what's kind of the upper limit there?
Sure. Well, we have to distinguish between printed books and notebooks and manuscripts. Notebooks and manuscripts can be unfathomably expensive. Bill Gates paid, I believe, well over $50 million for Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks. But printed books, you know, the books like we buy at a bookstore or from Amazon that we hold in our hand, those books can also have astronomical values. The copy of Shakespeare's First Folio went for, the last time one sold it, it went for, you know, on the order of, I think it was about $10 million. And then the most expensive or the highest price ever paid for a single printed volume of a book was a little over $14 million for a book called the Bay Psalm Book. And that's one of just 11 copies of the first book printed in America. So when you are unhappy about having to fork over $35 for a novel or book that you really want to read, you know, somebody paid $14 million for one copy of a book.
I wonder if this kind of book theft is very common. I mean, I'm sure that people steal books, but, you know, just for three chests worth to go missing.
Yeah. This theft was unique. There has never been one theft that resulted in so many books disappearing at one fell swoop. There are rare book dealers and antiquarian dealers all over the world, and they lose things all the time. People come in and they see a beautiful book, and you know, they're dishonest, and they see an opportunity to stick it in their briefcase, and they'll walk out the door with it. And that happens, sadly, with too great a frequency. In some cases, it's because they think they can make some money selling it. Very often, it's just somebody who wants to have that book on their shelf. You know, there was a terrible looting of a famous Baroque library in Naples, Italy, that took place, in which something on the order of a total of 1,500 books were stolen over a period. You know, tremendously valuable books by the, you know, the greatest minds of European history. And it turns out that it was actually the director of the library stealing them, some of which he kept for his own collection, and others of which he handed over to friends who just wanted to have them on their shelves. You know, many of them he attempted to sell through a network of, you know, dishonest dealers. But there are people who will steal books simply to, you know, to say they own this early copy by, you know, Aristotle or Dante or Milton.
Well, let's talk about these thieves, because it doesn't sound like, I mean, they don't fall into that category. They were obviously doing this for profit. I mean, I think, because but it's hard to know because it'd be hard to sell the book. So, you know, can you tell us a little bit about the thieves so we can maybe try to figure out or what have you puzzled out that was really their motivation?
Sure. So this was an extraordinary group of well-organized, sophisticated thieves who originated in a remote region of all places, Romania. Most of us would be hard-pressed to put our fingers on this region. It's the northeastern corner of Romania up against the Republic of Moldova. You know, tell me whether you know where that is on the map.
I have to admit, no, I could not identify that region.
Yeah. So it's an impoverished region of small ancient cities and farms. But it's part of the European Union. And these thieves formed a gang that figured that they could fly into other parts of the European Union and then carry out robberies and bring the stolen items either back home or fence them immediately, and that the authorities in these distant countries would never even know that they had been there. And they orchestrated these thefts at various warehouses, and most significantly at this warehouse holding the rare books. They would fly in a crew of about three or four accomplished burglars who were capable of extraordinarily acrobatic thefts, and they would come in, carry out a theft, ship the goods to a house that had been rented, or drive the goods to a house that had been rented. Somebody else would come in with a van. They would transfer the goods to a van, and the van would proceed out of the Channel Tunnel into France and then drive back the 1,500 miles to Romania. And then that group of thieves, some members would get back on airplanes, fly out. Others would come in, and then they'd embark on their next heist. It was an extraordinarily sophisticated clockwork series of raids that they were carrying out. And the amazing thing is that all of this was done by people who really had no exceptional education. They had no the owner of one of the warehouses said to me, I'm sure these guys had to be either circus acrobats or they had to have military special operations training. But in fact, it was just through their physical experience of going about breaking into places, climbing up walls and lowering themselves down, that they were able to carry out these thefts. And somehow they knew what was inside a warehouse. Somehow they knew how to avoid the detection by the various alarms and how to break in without being spotted by the cameras, and then get the materials back out the way they came in and disappear into the night.
Well, Mark Wortman, maybe the local authorities in Romania really weren't paying attention to them. But if they're stealing things in London, I mean, there are European, you know, agencies that watch these kind of things, policing force and intelligence agencies. I mean, were they not on anybody's radar?
These individuals, some of them had records, but because they were in the country, in some cases under false identification papers, and because they were citizens of the European, residents of the European Union, they could go across borders without being stopped. So that, you know, it was not a simple matter to find out who they were. And in fact, Scotland Yard discovered the car that was used to transport the thieves to the site of the break-in to steal the rare books and then to get away. And these the thieves had they found the car, and the thieves had all but cleaned out any traces. In fact, there was a minor trace of DNA that was found on the headrest, and that began to help crack the case open for Scotland Yard. And then there was also a major break that took place in Romania. And it was actually the Romanian authorities who really brought the gang, the evidence against the gang, together.
Well, I want to talk about those breaks in the case, and I'm going to ask you where the thieves finally stashed the books back in Romania. Mark Wortman is an award-winning popular historian and journalist, and today we're talking to him about his most recent article in April's Vanity Fair titled The Case of the Purloined Books. Constant Wonder will be right back in just one moment. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Our guest today is Mark Wortman. He's an award-winning popular historian and journalist, and we're talking to him about his article in the latest Vanity Fair titled The Case of the Purloined Books. So how did the case start to crack open? You mentioned the van, but the local authorities start to get involved as well.
Yeah. So in Romania, the chief prosecutor for organized crime, about 3 weeks after the books were stolen in London and spirited out of the country, she got a call from a source. She wouldn't tell me who that source is, but a person called her up and said there were books stolen, and they were rare, valuable books, and they were brought back to Romania. And then at first she just thought the whole thing had to be a joke. She hadn't heard about this, about the theft. But then the caller mentioned the nicknames of three people, two of whom were not familiar to her, but one of whom, somebody he called Christy the Bruiser, was a name that she knew from a previous case, one that had been involving a notorious human trafficking case that she where she brought the leader of that gang to justice. And he, this Christy the Bruiser, it turns out, had been the godson of the leader of that human trafficking gang, and she knew that name. And so that, she said, was the flashlight that went off. And so she called her counterpart, the leader of the police charged with investigating organized crime, and said, "We've got a big case here. Let's get on this one." And then she became obsessed with searching it out the books, you know, almost like she was a book collector herself. she wanted to get those books back. And so then her police inspector met with the Scotland Yard people at Europol, which is the European-wide police consortium that to investigate crimes that go across national borders. And that began a search for this gang, or for the thieves behind the book thefts. So the combination of Scotland Yard getting some DNA, which they were then able, thanks to the people in Romania, to identify one of the thieves involved in the rare book theft, and then this tip about the involvement of Christy the Bruiser provided the initial clues that helped them to begin to investigate and identify the members of the gang, and to understand that this was principally a gang of Romanian thieves. There, as it turned out, there was also a British national involved, as well as Romanians who were living in England, and one other who was living in Germany. And they began to trace the whereabouts of some of the individuals, and that allowed them to start piecing together this network that was a sort of rotating cast coming in and out of London and then heading back out to their home countries, principally Romania, after having carried out a brazen raid on another warehouse.
So how long did the whole process take to, because you say it's a rotating cast, so it's more than just a couple people. So I imagine they had to round them all up. But how long did it take till they were ready to move in?
So it took more than 2.5 years. When I was speaking with the chief police inspector in Romania, he said to me, "It's not what you know, it's what you can prove." So then they were also very fearful that if they moved too quickly, the books would disappear forever. You know, you could create an entire large museum out of stolen artwork that has disappeared. You know, a Museum of Lost Art would house some of the most important artworks in history, and they've never been recovered. So they were very fearful that they might not recover these books if they moved too fast. And then they wanted to have a rock-solid case. You know, and in the meanwhile, this revolving cast of thieves, of coordinators, of financiers. It turned out that Christie the Bruiser had a record himself. It turned out he had organized the gang, and he had financed it. And then there was another member of the gang who was an operations chief, and he would come in to London, and he would be on the ground and helping to make sure that all the pieces were coming together as the raids were taking place. There was somebody else who would lease rooms. There was another person who would drive in with the van. And then there was somebody who was buying the airplane tickets. And so within, in typical fashion, they'd fly in 2 days before. They'd rent a car. They'd rent a room. In the night, they would break into a warehouse, and within 2 days after that, the entire gang, all of its loot, would simply disappear out of the country.
So when they finally were ready, I mean, they felt like they could prove their case. How'd they go about catching them all?
Yeah.
I'm assuming that these heists were continuing, that they were continuing to steal across Europe. And so, I don't know, maybe everybody wasn't all in Romania when they wanted to move in.
So they actually had a coordinating center set up at Europol headquarters in The Hague, in the Netherlands. And out of there, they ran 45 separate raids on what they called Z-Day, the sort of the end date of this 2.5 year investigation. And those 45 raids led to the arrests of a total of 15 people in Germany, England, Romania. About 6 months later, one of the leaders of the gang who had managed to elude capture was finally found and arrested in Turin, Italy. And then they were all brought to England for trial. And the people from Scotland Yard and the people from Romania were all going to be part of the testimony against these people. There were an initial 12 who were brought to trial. Or I should say there was an initial 13 who were brought to trial. And they were their trials began they began in February of 2020. But as you know, we had an extraordinary event begin at that point.
So what happened? Where are they?
So because you're talking about so many people, lawyers, interpreters, judge, jury, press, guards. Basically, you would have in the midst of the pandemic, you would have needed a courtroom the size of an arena in order to hold the trial safely. So they were all sent back to prison, where they sat. And finally, in September of this past year, the defendants, all but one, decided that they would plead guilty because they were simply sitting in jail and they were in sort of miserable conditions because of the pandemic. Effectively, nobody could move. Everybody was as isolated as possible. And they decided that rather than just stay in jail waiting for the date when they could be brought to trial in a safe manner, which nobody could really predict when that would be, their attorneys, 12 of the 13 who were brought to trial, decided that they would plead guilty.
Because how long would their sentences have been, you know, if they had gone to trial and versus a plea deal?
I can't tell you how long they would have been, but if they had continued to plead innocent, which they had done initially, and then had been found guilty, they potentially could have had quite significant sentences. I can't tell you the exact amount, but I can tell you by pleading guilty without going to trial, the longest sentence was for Christie the Bruiser, who was the financier and brains behind the operation. And he received 5 years and 8 month sentence.
Yeah.
And some of the operatives, the foot soldiers, as they were known, who were carrying out the actual break-ins, they received sentences primarily in the 3 year and a few months range.
Okay, so we have to know, did they find the books? And were the books okay?
So this story has a happy ending. The authorities at Scotland Yard, through some intelligence that they would not reveal, confirmed the suspicions of the people on the ground in Romania that one of the leading members of the gang and his brother, who was also part of the gang, had brought the books back to a house that they had built in the countryside in northeastern Romania. And so last September, shortly before the men came to trial in London, the Romanian authorities raided the house. They found the books in a bunker under a concrete slab in the garage of the house. The chief inspector who had been on the case for almost 3 years told me that he personally, you know, they brought out a jackhammer, they broke up the concrete. He personally took the shovel to the concrete to scoop it away. He said it was a very tense moment. You know, they had been working so hard. He was really in fear of damaging the book, books. And he took a shovel, scraped away the concrete, and there they were. There they were. They had been packed in large blue recycling bins and in some cases in the bags that the gangs had used to spirit the books out of the warehouse. Some of the books had damage. Some spines on some of the books were broken. Some of the books had some dampness or water stains. But by and large, the books were in terrific condition. And the police took those books. They brought them to the National Library in Bucharest, Romania, the capital of Romania, where they were laid out in a specially climate-controlled room. And they invited all the book dealers to come to Romania and identify their books. I spoke with one of the book dealers. He said it was an extraordinary moment. He said these were fantastic books. He said to me in sort of with an Italian accent, he said, I felt like the youngest book dealer in the world when I saw my books.
Well, we love a happy ending here on Constant Wonder. So thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Oh, thank you for your interest, Tenery. It was a great, fun story to cover. And, you know, there just aren't enough stories with good endings, and this one did have that.
Mark Wortman is a journalist and the author of several books and articles about the American military and social history. His latest book is 1941, Fighting the Shadow War. To get the full story of this heist we've been discussing today, check out The Case of the Purloined Books in the April issue of Vanity Fair. This is Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor.
And I'm Marcus Smith. So we've just been told that book heists rarely involve cat burglars with repelling gear because all you really need is a librarian gone bad. We've got such a classic case of literary thievery coming up next when Constant Wonder returns in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. We're going to stick with book heists now, and once again, we're talking about books worth millions of dollars. The crook in this case was not as professional, you could say, as the Romanian mob, but he may have been a bit smarter. I got the story from Travis McDade, the curator of law rare books and an associate professor of library science at the University of Illinois College of Law.
In many ways, the guy who's committing this crime didn't know what he had. He stole a first edition, The Wealth of Nations. He stole from John James Audubon's Quadrupeds of North America from 1851 to 1854. He stole the Principia Mathematica, maybe the most important and famous science book of all time.
Is that Isaac Newton?
Yeah, Newton. Yeah. And there's been a complete census of Principias in the world, which means we know where all of them are. It's one of those books that it's so valuable and people have such an interest in it that when one comes up for sale, it's a big enough deal that people investigate it and pay attention to where it came from. And so you can sort of trace the provenance of the owner of each copy of the Principia, who has owned it since, I think, 1687 is when it was printed. He stole one of those. I mean, he stole their copy of it and sold it to a buddy. The Native American Edward Curtis prints from the early 20th century were just amazing and historically important, and there were only 272 of these sets created, and they were very valuable, and the Carnegie Library had spent a lot of money to get their copy because they knew how valuable this thing was, and he just cut out all these plates from here and sold them piecemeal. It was that's why I say vandalism. It was the people who discovered this, you got sick to their stomach. One of the ladies who worked there cried. And these are natural emotions when you see the destruction that was wrought on this library by this man.
Yeah. Well, you've named him once. I need you to give the name again and tell us what put him in a position where he even had access to this material.
Greg Priory is his name. He's the son of Pittsburgh, as I mentioned. And he was working in what was called the Pennsylvania Room. And he was interested in archives, and he had an MA in history from Duquesne, and got a job there, and was going to library school because he was interested in archives management, and so worked in the library already when the administration at the Carnegie Library had this idea to have this special room, and he seemed like the perfect person to put in charge. And in many ways he was, because he really cared about Pittsburgh and he knew his stuff when it came to history. And he was gregarious. He was the sort of guy who, would like to point these things out to you. And by all indications, he was sort of fastidious with the collection. That's one of the great things about this is he kept it safe. He made sure that the security was up to snuff. There were many different security apparatuses that were put into effect to keep this place safe, and he sort of watched it like a hawk. And right the way along, he was stealing from his own collection.
Yeah, this is kind of like the story of the preacher who preaches for a long career about fidelity to one spouse, and then you find out he's has an affair on the side, and maybe he's a TV evangelist too. I don't know, but you told the story of him having a master's degree in history. And studying library science, people who go down that road, from my experience, they tend to have a real reverence for these old materials.
Yeah. Yeah, I will say, increasingly, unfortunately, that is the pool of people from which we get these thieves. The days of large-scale outsider theft from special collections libraries are behind us, which is a good thing. But that means that the people who have access to this material and who steal from it are largely insiders. The reason that most of these guys do it is not obviously because they want to have these things in their house, and not because they love these things. It's because they're not making enough money, or they think they're not making enough money, and they need to supplement their income some way, and they just sort of look at this collection they have at their disposal and decide to avail themselves of it.
I guess. But how much is enough? Because if you start stealing and you steal $8 million worth of material, and I don't know if that was the sale price total that he got from this, but however much, maybe he only made $3 million, maybe only $2 million. At some point, you think an average person could pay their bills.
So he didn't get anything like that. The $8 million was the price tag that was given to the insurance company, who, to their credit, paid most of it for the replacement value for these things that were stolen. I don't know how much he got, honestly. It was definitely in the six figures and maybe seven figures, but you know, the bank records don't go back that far. The police actually only went back about 5 years to just get enough evidence to make sure they can indict him. So he had four kids and they all went to local private schools. And that's one of the questions I have about this is, you know, he and his wife lived in this apartment with these kids a couple blocks away from the library. And, you know, who knew what? Was he the only one who knew what was going on? Did anyone ever question why he was able to have four kids in local private schools and Duquesne? Several of them went to Duquesne and he was footing the bill there. You know, that does add up after a while. As a father with kids myself, I do know how much that sort of thing eventually costs. And there is evidence that he was really just barely getting by, trying to foot all these bills at once.
Yeah.
There's no indication that he was living this opulent lifestyle, or that he had a drug habit, or that he had something that took a lot of money. It other than kids, I don't know if that's the sorriest part of this story, but it's certainly a depressing idea.
Well, I want you to fold in now some connection, perhaps tangential, but maybe not, and it has to do with the Antiques Roadshow.
So about a week ago in Romania, I don't know if you saw this, they found a couple of hundred very rare and old books that had been stolen 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, from a warehouse outside Heathrow Airport. Now, these were all books that were owned by European booksellers who were on their way to California to sell them at a book fair. And so these were very valuable books, including another copy of the Principia. And they were in a warehouse waiting transport to the United States. And these professional thieves cut through a fence, got on top of this warehouse, tunneled down through a skylight, and sort of suspended themselves above the floor, Mission Impossible style, so they wouldn't set off these alarms. And then gathered all these books up, a couple hundred of these books, into duffel bags, sent them back out the top, and then into a waiting car that they drove through the streets of London until they came to their second vehicle. They ditched the original one, and then they drove on. And it turns out that these guys were part of Romanian organized crime, and they had this particular aptitude for breaking into warehouses and stealing these sorts of things, especially around airports.
But what they usually that's quite a specialization.
It is. Well, what they usually stole were like laptops, that sort of thing. And when you're stealing electronics or laptops or cars or whatever, you can turn around and with a few keystrokes, or you scratch some numbers off, you can sell them for something close to retail price. But when you steal rare books, of which there are only a few, and in some of these cases there were only a couple in the world, you literally cannot sell them to anyone, because the only people who are in the market to pay you what those things are worth know the provenance of the books that they want, right? They know where these things will have come from. And they will also know that there was a major crime, because this crime was secret for about 6 hours. And so when this happened in January 2017, I predicted what was going to happen. Either all of these things were going to be set on fire so these guys wouldn't get caught, or they were going to be kept as a group somewhere and discovered at some date in the future, because they couldn't sell these. And sure enough, that's what happened. They found these things. So the worst way, literally the worst way to steal books is this really polished, planned out professional way where you steal these books, cat burglar style, and then you get on the outside and you have this, you know, all of these really theoretically valuable books that are worth nothing because no one's going to buy them for you, right?
It doesn't work on eBay, does it?
It doesn't. Well, that's the only thing they could do is to sell things on eBay, but these things were all way too high priced. They would have set off alarms even on eBay. Priory, on the other hand, did the opposite of that thing, right? Priory stole things piecemeal. He would cut a map out, and then he would, you know, just go and try to sell it. And then he had the most important part of this aspect, which these gangsters didn't have. He had a fence. He had a reliable fence. Most of the guys who get caught, most of the other librarians who steal from their own collection, get caught trying to sell these things on eBay, actually. He had, Priory had, this great connection with a local bookseller of great renown, a man named John Shulman, who, as you mentioned, had been on Antiques Roadshow. You can go on Antiques Roadshow now and see a couple of his episodes. And so this guy had a great reputation. He was a member of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America. He was well known. He'd been in the business in Pittsburgh since the 1980s. Everyone in the business knew him. He was incredibly reliable. He was gregarious. He went to all the book fairs. It was this perfect combination of a man who had access to a nearly limitless supply of good material, and then the guy who could dispose of them without drawing any attention. And it was the exact opposite of this what seemed like this professionally done crime in the UK and Romania. Because those guys got all the goods, but then they didn't have the most important part, which is an ability to sell it, right? But these two, Shulman and Priory, had a perfect situation. You had the one guy who could steal the thing and the other guy who could sell it, and they got away with it for 25 years. No one even, you know, sniffed it out for 2.5 decades. It's incredible. It's an incredible, long-lasting crime.
So 25 years, you say, this was just a little trickle of materials now and then, and that was part of the cover, too, that there was no major awareness that all of a sudden something's missing.
And the other interesting thing that made this as close to a perfect rare book theft as you're going to find is, so if you think about it, if someone ever discovers that the thing that they bought on eBay or the thing they bought from a bookseller is a suspect, or they can tell by looking at it that it belongs in a particular collection, what they always do, they do one of two things. They either call the bookseller from whom they bought it, or they call the library from which they know it came. And this is the way that so many of these guys are caught. Nine-tenths of these guys are caught because someone sees something for sale on eBay or wherever they know shouldn't be for sale. Then they call the library and say, hey, this thing's for sale. And then they trace it, you know, the administration or whomever, track it down and find the person to blame. In this case, someone did on two occasions find something that they knew was rare enough that there were only a few places that had it. And one of them was the Carnegie Library. And they called the Carnegie Library and they talked to Greg Priory, who said, oh, no, you know, it's right here on the shelf, right? So there were a couple of times when there were close calls. But if people had called Shulman would have said, no, you know, let me call the library or send it back. I'll give you a full refund. And then he would have just, you know, taken it back and they would have maybe reinserted it into the collection or something. But they had this sort of thing where these two guys were sort of looking out for each other. And so even if someone did find something amiss, they, you know, they would call one of the two guys who was responsible for it.
Yeah. Now, confessions from them after they were detected, were they forthcoming? Are they tight-lipped about it? Are they saying much about it? And I guess they've been sentenced now and doing time.
This is one of the really interesting things about it. So I've been thinking about this a lot. So he was stealing, obviously, for a couple of decades, and he would steal a map here, an illustration there, sometimes a book. And if you steal a map from an atlas, right, just think about this. If you have an atlas in your house and you take one map from it, no one's going to miss it, right? And if you steal 5 maps, maybe no one will miss that. And if you steal 25, maybe you can even get around that. And I've tried to sort of figure out at what point he'd stolen enough things that there was no getting around it, right? And that he was just like, I'm going to sort of go whole hog and steal everything from this thing. And then I'll just stick the binding way out of sight on the top shelf, which is what he did with a lot of these things that he cannibalized. So I think at some point he had to know, as soon as someone poked around, as soon as someone asked questions internally about these things and needed to see these things, it was over. It was curtains. And then in the fall of 2016, the administration said that they wanted to do a complete census of the collection to get a sense of what was in the collection value-wise, right? They had had one of these done when they founded the Oliver Room in the early 90s. They wanted to have another one done in 2017. And he must have known then. He argued against this. He was angry at the idea of doing this. He didn't think it was necessary. And he must have known then, in October of 2016, that as soon as these people came in and took a look, he was going to be done. And that's what happened. They came in in early April and found these things missing. And when the police, he didn't, you know, they didn't fire him immediately. It took a couple of months. But when the police eventually did come to his house in, I think it was June, he almost immediately, you know, gave it all up and rolled over on Shulman and said, you know, what they've been doing all this time.
You know, I don't generally empathize deeply with criminals, but I do like to try to imagine what it would feel like for all those years to have a clock kind of ticking in the background and knowing at some level, at least suspecting, that you're going to get caught. And that's just got to be a miserable way. How do you even sleep at night? Have you thought about that?
I have thought about that a lot. You know, with some of these guys that I write about, there is at least, like, there's a glimmer of hope in their eyes that, or in their mind, that they won't get caught, right? That they steal a few enough things, or they steal things that are not valuable enough that people will necessarily care that they're gone, that maybe you could have a whole career and you could retire and maybe someone will discover some things missing, but they won't make that big a deal about it. They'll just think, you know, they just got displaced or something. You know, at some point he had to know that as soon as someone started poking around for real, that he was in real trouble. There was no getting around it. And I did sort of wonder, you know, he had 6 or 7 months when he knew, you know, the sword of Damocles was actually going to fall in the spring of 2017 and the holidays he went through knowing, you know, Thanksgiving, he knew this was coming. In Christmas, he knew this was coming, right? All of these things, all of these milestones he knew were coming, or he knew what was coming down the pike. And I sort of decided that at some point, and again, this is sort of psychological stuff that I thought about myself, is that at some point he just decided that he was going to send his kids to the best schools that he possibly could. He was going to get caught eventually. He was going to go to prison eventually. And that was the price he was going to pay for sending his kids to these schools. And as it turns out, he didn't even have to pay that price. He and Shulman were both sentenced to house arrest and 3 years for Priory house arrest and 4 years for Shulman and 12 years probation.
Travis McDade is the curator of Law Rare Books and an associate professor of library science at the University of Illinois College of Law. Ice hockey is not just about fights on the ice. It's also about speed and elegance, finesse, power. And there's a story about how it came to be one of the most beloved spectator sports in the world and how ice hockey sent ripples, wrong metaphor with ice, ripples through the entire industry of sports broadcasting. That's up next on Constant Wonder.